Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak was ousted by popular demand on January 25th of 2011, but that was hardly the end of the conflict and protests in Egypt.
Although the media moved its attention to Syria and then other parts of the world, protests and violence continued in Egypt, and President Mohamed Morsi struggled to form a cohesive government.
When Morsi was taken into military custody earlier this summer, violence broke out, and Egypt's narrative of a successful revolution and transition into a democracy came into serious question.
Vice President and co-founder of Global Post, Charles Sennett, has been reporting on the events in Egypt since the revolution began over 2.5 years ago. And his frontline documentary, Egypt in Crisis, airs on Wisconsin Public Television at 9 o'clock tonight. Charles, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you were there at the beginning of the Arab Spring in Egypt. What did you see then?
Well, I think everyone remembers those days in early 2011 when there were millions of people gathering in Tahrir Square. Tahrir means Liberation Square. So it was really a powerful rallying point for what was called the Facebook revolution, if you remember, and all these young people online coordinating, pulling together, and suddenly, you know, I've covered the Middle East for more than 25 years, but when I watched that, I saw something I thought I'd never see, which was people power, a pro-democracy movement, toppling Hosni Mubarak, who had ruled Egypt very brutally, a great deal of corruption as a police state, which you know, we should be embarrassed to know that it was, of course, very strongly backed by the United States. And here it was being toppled, and relatively peaceful demonstrations. Yes, there was violence. There were deaths. It wasn't all pretty. The deaths were mostly caused by the military and police cracking down, mostly police cracking down on the crowd. But if you sum it all up, it was a historic turning point. It was really at the height of the Arab Spring, the height of optimism, and nothing could have been further away from that hope than what we saw this summer.
It is incredible looking back, because watching from afar on television the way most Americans did, it did seem like this incredible breakthrough moment. There's even a shot of you in this documentary smiling while you're watching a protest singer, and you can tell that you felt and the people there felt like you were witnessing something historic and monumental and very hopeful fundamentally. But that's not exactly what happened. What happened next?
Well, you know, that yes, you're right. The film really is about a journey of this team from Frontline and Global Post. Cameraman Tim Grugia, who's an amazing shooter, and the producer Martin Smith, and our field producers Mohamed Sabri and others. We all were absolutely enraptured, I guess you'd have to say, by this very positive feeling of a revolution unfolding before your eyes. And what's happened is different, but I want to stress the idea that as dispiriting as the events of this summer were, as it descended into violence, as the popularly elected president, the first president elected in free and fair elections in 5,000 years, was forced out in a coup, put under detention in an undisclosed location. Despite all of that, I still think that kernel of hope, that yearning for democracy, is there on the streets of Cairo. And one of the big challenges for American foreign policy, and really for everyone, is how do you take that energy and how do you allow it to go forward to really become a true democracy in a country where faith, Islam, is very important to the vast majority of the people, and that they want their leaders to be informed by their faith? Can Islam survive in a democratic setting? How does democracy include the Islamists, but not exclude the Christian minority or exclude women? And I think America owes it to Egypt, if I could be so bold. I'm not usually so editorial about these things, but I've spent a lot of time there. And I really think it's a fair assertion that we owe it to the Egyptians. We backed a tyrant there for a long time. We somehow, I think, owe it to them to help them figure that out. And we need to be proactive about it, and we need to be sophisticated about it.
Well, you follow the events unfolding there through the thread of the Muslim Brotherhood. That is the strand that you keep watching. And it's been fascinating to watch how that group has has sort of, in the beginning, finessed their position, gone on to take power, and then, you know, what's happened from there. But let's start with when you first came across the Muslim Brotherhood in those revolutionary days. What did the organization seem like then?
Well, you know, if I could, I'd back up even a little further, and I'd say, you know, Muslim Brotherhood's 80 years old. When I first came into Egypt, it was early 90s, actually it was 1993, right after the first World Trade Center bombing, when an Egyptian cleric, Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, inspired a small group that would be now looked upon as nascent al-Qaeda to try to take down the towers. They blew up the parking garage, if you remember. Six people were killed, but the towers remained standing. But their intent was to topple them. And that's when I first went to Egypt and first met the Muslim Brotherhood. They rejected violence. They embraced democracy, even though they were an underground movement. And that's what set them apart from Islamic Jihad and this emerging notion of al-Qaeda, which the Egyptian Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's now the head of al-Qaeda, was part of this split in Egypt. And that's a really important piece of history that I think a lot of people don't know. We tend to blur the lines that what's really the difference between Muslim Brotherhood and al-Qaeda. There's a profound difference. And one is that the Muslim Brotherhood have rejected violence and they have embraced democracy. And the al-Qaeda, as we all know, rejects democracy and embraces violence. To the point where they say that those Muslim Brotherhood members who believe that they can actually be democratically elected and allowed to rule are kidding themselves, that democracy is a front of the West. Now, you know, I certainly don't believe that, but it's important to know that that's a conversation on the street where al-Qaeda is saying to young men, mostly men, in the Muslim Brotherhood, you're foolish to believe in democracy. And I just think we need to be aware of that conversation and understand the importance of recognizing their adherence to democracy. Now, were they good leaders? Did they have good governance? I don't think anyone thinks they did. They were terrible. The Muslim Brotherhood forced through a constitution that was far too Islamist for most Egyptians' taste. They excluded women. They excluded the Christian minority. They did very little to protect the Christian minority.
Well, let's back up a little and have you tell me what role the Muslim Brotherhood played in that revolt against Hosni Mubarak.
Sorry, I skipped over that. Yes, you're right. So during those days in Tahrir Square, the Muslim Brotherhood was really instrumental, I would argue, in combining forces with the youth movement, the Facebook generation. They came into it a little bit late, but when they did come into it, to those days on Tahrir Square, they came with great organizational skill. They were an underground movement for many years, and they brought their ability to organize to the revolution. And I think even the Facebook crowd would tell you they played a very big role in getting the numbers that led to the pressure that ultimately toppled Hosni Mubarak.
It's interesting. It's a complicated thing because they were part of the revolution. They were right up there on the bully pulpit when Mubarak was brought down. And yet there were many people interviewed in your documentary who said, well, at least they gave the impression that the Muslim Brotherhood was sort of hijacking the revolution and promoting things that they didn't believe in.
Yeah, again, thank you for watching it so carefully. That's a really good point. And the young man who we interviewed way back in 2011, you know, what he was professing was something that comes from what I would say is a relatively small secular elite. If you looked at him, he was wearing a tie-dye T-shirt, and he was in a very expensive tent. Remember, all the tents were set up in Tahrir Square?
Mm-hmm.
Most people who were young and poor, like most Egyptians, just had plastic tarps, and they have very old clothes. He is very much reflective of a part of Cairo that is elite. And I would say his concerns were genuine, and he said, I fear that they're hijacking our revolution. And there were definitely young people who feared that. But the vast majority of Egyptians are traditional. They have deep faith, and they respect the Muslim Brotherhood for toughing it out for 80 years. What they don't respect in the Muslim Brotherhood is what came in the next act, where, remember now, there were elections, the first free and fair elections in 5,000 years of Egyptian history, and the Muslim Brotherhood came to power in those parliamentary elections. They took 40% of parliament, And when you combine them with the other Islamist parties, they were more than two-thirds of the parliament. So a big expression from the voters of a belief that the Islamists should play a role in the future democracy of a new Egypt. But, like I was saying before when I got a bit ahead of myself, they failed. Their governance was not good. No one liked it. And so, after watching the Constitution pushed through, after watching many failures in the economy and elsewhere by the Muslim Brotherhood, and particularly giving too much power to the military, which is ironic now, of course, but the Muslim Brotherhood gave a lot of power to the military, really everything it wanted. And then suddenly people said, you know, we don't want this Muslim Brotherhood government. And an amazing show of popular support for overthrowing, or at least calling for early elections of Morsi, President Morsi, who came out of the Muslim Brotherhood political party. And did you watch those on television on June 30th when 20 million people took to the streets of Egypt and demanding that President Morsi, democratically elected, coming out of the Muslim Brotherhood, step down and call early elections because he was failing? So as many thoughtful Egyptians described this to me, it was an impeachment from the street, as one person put it.
No.
And, you know, that might be true, but it was also the military that moved in. So it also felt very much to Egyptians like a military coup.
What do you think, you know, we've just got less than a minute before we stop to take a check of news, but was part of the problem with the Muslim Brotherhood at that moment in the leadership that they were too complicit with the army?
Yes, that was a deep concern. And there's this notion that we get at in the film of the deep state, that the military is really secretly controlling the economy. Some estimates as much as 40% of the private sector economy is controlled by the military, that they control the country, that they control the government. And it certainly seems the case. In the end of our film, as we assert, you know, it's very hard to see this any other way than the deep state, the military, is back in charge, and democracy and the road ahead remains something that's going to have to be defined in the future.
We are talking right now with Charles Sennett, Vice President and co-founder of Global Post and correspondent for Frontline's Egypt in Crisis. We'll keep on talking with him after we stop to check the state news. And if you'd like to weigh in on the topic we're discussing right now, you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Noah Avshinsky, and you're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Noah Ovshinsky in for Rob Ferret.
We're continuing our conversation now with Charles Sennett, the vice president and co-founder of Global Post, about his Frontline documentary, Egypt in Crisis, which airs on Wisconsin Public Television tonight at 9 o'clock. And Charles, we were talking a little bit earlier. You introduced the term deep state. Could you tell us a little more about what that is when it comes to Egypt?
Yeah, the deep state is a word you hear a lot these days in Egypt. And the deep state refers to the presence that the military has throughout life in Egypt. It really is ubiquitous. The military controls vast land holdings. They build huge developments, housing developments, business developments. They control the ports. They control the toll roads. They control most of the industries. They control bottled water. They control the baking of bread. It's really a hard to imagine the extent to which the military is involved in the private sector economy.
It is hard to imagine. I mean, why do they do all that? Why does the military bake bread in Egypt? I don't understand.
Well. One thing that's true of Egypt's history from ancient times is that bread is one of the most important commodities, of course, in so many cultures, but that bread riots are a real fear in Egypt, that if the price of bread rises too high, riots can break out, and they have in different periods in history. But it's of course, no beneficent effort on the part of the military. It's cronyism. It's sort of Nasserist socialism meets military junta. You know, this is not uncommon. It's also the case in Burma and in other military juntas. But we in America have thought of Egypt as a country that we support, of course, with economic aid and military aid for decades. we think of them as signing the peace deal with Israel. And we haven't really focused on the brutality of that state as a police state under Mubarak until the uprisings happened and Mubarak was overthrown. So that deep state has been there for a very, very long time. One of the things that the revolutionaries, the people who really fought hard for a democracy in Egypt, they want to see the military come under civilian review. And the military has been very resistant to that. And that's one of the big tensions now in Egypt is it's very true that the military is a trusted institution and a respected one. Hard to imagine when they've got that level of cronyism, I guess, going on, but it is. And the Egyptian people view it that way. General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who is now heading the transitional government as the general in charge, so therefore really effectively leading the country right now, is popular. He's young for a general. He's sort of, I guess some people would see him as ruggedly handsome. And he's the guy right now who's in control, and he's the face of that military and that deep state. And I guess the Egyptians have collectively expressed to many of us who've been reporting there that as long as they hold new elections in early 2014, that they support this transition. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood, which represents another large sector of Egypt, they don't support this. They think that the elected president was kicked out in a military coup, and they can't understand why the United States isn't more up in arms about that. And I think you can see both sides in this, and that's one of the really complex parts of Egypt right now, is that the country is divided, and that on one side is the popularly elected party of the Muslim Brotherhood that feels its election was stolen from them by the street, and on the other side is the street, which says we don't want the Muslim Brotherhood and we're going to allow the military to take over in an interim. Now, will the military give up power? Will those elections go forward? Will the deep state recede and allow democracy to come forward? Huge questions, and I think it's what we try in the film to say is the reason that your listeners, and I'd argue the whole country of the United States, needs to think about what's going on in Egypt. It's a big test case for democracy in the post-Arab Spring, and it will have regional ramifications if it fails, and it will have, you know, good ramifications, positive ramifications if it succeeds. So I think we have a lot invested in working toward the success of democracy in a place like Egypt.
Well, when Egypt did rewrite its constitution, did it include some of the reforms that the revolutionaries were asking for?
Good question. And the short answer is no. I mean, the constitution was not liked, and it was very much one of the greatest failings of the Muslim Brotherhood's leadership under President Morsi and his political party, was that the constitution reflected too much of their religious agenda, too much social engineering. And people rejected it. And Morsi didn't listen to them. And he was not inclusive. And he did not include the rights of women enough, many women felt. He did not protect the rights of the Christian minority, according to the Christians. And that was, I think, maybe his greatest weakness that led to the enormous public uprising in the streets, calling for him to call for these early elections and to leave office.
Well, how would you describe how the Muslim Brotherhood is standing right now? What is next for them?
Right now, they're deeply underground. I'd say they're crushed. I would say that the Muslim Brotherhood is the leadership is largely under arrest, often on very trumped-up charges. Those who aren't under arrest have warrants for their arrest, and they're literally in hiding. Much of the Muslim Brotherhood wasn't based in Cairo. It was based in the more rural areas outside of Cairo, or in the very poor areas on the fringes of Cairo, big, sprawling, poor neighborhoods in Cairo where they very effectively set up their own kindergartens and health clinics and things that the government never provided for those poor neighborhoods, and where they're very popular and where they can hide. And they've basically gone back underground. And a very observant analyst in Egypt said, you know, this is their narrative. This is where they're the most comfortable, is underground as an underdog, trying to fight against the state. And I think we would not be good students of history if we thought this was going to work. The Muslim Brotherhood organizes even more effectively this way, and it's going to come back, and it's going to assert itself. And the big question will be, you know, will it assert itself democratically, as it has for so many decades, even though it was outlawed? Or will there be breakaway factions that resort to violence? And I think it's a big question right now. And I think if there is violence coming from those breakaway factions, it's going to be really important to remember the history, that they tried democracy and they were thwarted in it. You know, and there are comparisons in the region, for example, to Algeria. In the early 90s, there were elections in Algeria. An Islamist government was elected. The military stepped in with tacit U.S. approval and crushed that election and took over in a coup. That caused a civil war inside Algeria that very few of us know about. I covered it, but it was very undercovered. And, you know, 75,000 people died in that civil war in Algeria that you didn't really ever hear about. But it was all over a military coup that thwarted the democratic aspirations of an Islamist movement. And I fear that if Egypt's too intent on pushing the Muslim Brotherhood underground, that there could be this backlash. And I'd hate to see that happen. Mm-hmm. It's a great country, and that shouldn't happen, and it doesn't have to happen. But I think we all need to know more about the hydraulics at work here.
Well, after President Morsi was ousted after the violence, you started to hear some of the hope, you know, that had been blooming from the Arab Spring. The erosion of that is what we heard, and people starting to think, some analysts saying, well, maybe it's not that easy to grow democracy. Maybe it takes more time. Maybe some of these countries have to go through more transition before they get there. So with all that in context and you having been there, we just have time for one more quick answer. But how optimistic are you that this will be a forward step for democracy in Egypt?
President Obama in June 2009 gave a really important speech in Cairo where he talked about democracy as a universal ideal. And he encouraged Muslims all over the Arab world to bring on democracy. They answered that call, you could argue, with the Arab Spring, and they overthrew tyrants, and they want democracy. But democracy takes a long time. It's boring, it's hard work, and it needs support. And that is something that I think the U.S. needs to think about, is how can we, through civil society, support democracy? Because the best way to defeat militancy, al-Qaeda, and Islamic violence, or Islamist violence, is through ideas. And I'd argue there's no greater idea than democracy. And that's the idea that if the U.S. can put forward, can help change the direction in the Middle East and hopefully end the violence.
Well, Charles, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Charles Sennett, Vice President and co-founder of Global Post and correspondent for Frontline's Egypt in Crisis. His documentary will air tonight on public television.